Welcome to the Grow Your Business podcast. Listen in as we discuss all things business, growth, and marketing with business owners, thought leaders, and entrepreneurs. And now, here's your host, founder of Roundhouse, the creative agency, Saul Edmonds.
Oh, hi, everyone, and welcome to the Grow Your Business podcast. Today, I'm speaking with Mark van der Bugaert about the topic. I guess we'll call it a topic, side hustling, a side hustle, coaching, hunting, and podcasting, and probably just about anything else we want to talk about. So Mark, you're into a lot of different stuff, and this is going to be pretty interesting. So what do you have to say for yourself about this topic?
Okay. So the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to say, though I've known you for 50 years, Saul, my name is Mark van der Bugaert.
Oh, whatever.
So that's the first thing you're going to say. So with that out of the way, let's crack this egg. So
who are you, Mark? So as a framework first, so we don't just like dive straight into abstract philosophical conversation. So people have some idea of like who you are, generally what you do, to provide a helpful framework for the audience listening.
Sure. So my name is Mark van der Bugaert. I am a Gen X 54-year-old. That's how old we are. Business owner. I live here in Brisbane. I'm a family man. I have a lovely wife and two golden boys who give me great fulfillment in my life.
So look great.
I've been told that the eldest looks like me. The youngest looks like my wife. However, the traits are not equally distributed. So my oldest has a number of traits that are very much like my wife, whereas the youngest has lots of traits that are like me. So I suppose that's the joy of the gene pool.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's part of it. And from a business point of view, for the last 10 years, I've worked as an executive coach across big business, so corporations, government, both state and federal. I don't think I've ever worked for local. And more recently, not-for-profit. So I've had an engagement with not-for-profits now for a number of not-for-profits running for a few years. But that doesn't I haven't disregarded the other clients. It's just a spreading of the client base. And what I do with those in that particular role is I provide executive coaching to executive leaders, senior leaders, and up-and-coming leaders or emerging leaders. And if I was to describe my approach to coaching, this might sound a little bit eclectic, but then again, it's probably a good way to describe myself. There's two types of skills as far as I can see in the world, the way we look at skills. We either look like skills that you inherit, they're a part of you. So you might, and I call that, that's Harry Potter magic. You're either born a wizard or you're not.
But that's really great too.
That's right. And that's great if you are a wizard, but it's not so great if you're not. The other type of magic is what I call practical magic, which is Penn and Teller, which means really what we're talking about here is practicing, refining, and developing skills over a period of time where they appear to be magical. Mm. And I'm very much about helping people develop practical magic in the realm of leadership. So how they lead themselves and how they lead with and through others. That's really my anchor point.
I like those metaphors. That's a good one, especially the Penn and Teller one. It's like the aspect, I suppose, too, which I haven't actually watched Penn and Teller for a while, but I do. That's the one thing that I always like about them is, well, not with everything that they do, but the fact that some of it's then sort of explained, but they don't explain everything because, of course, that would ruin it, but they explain enough to give people like this really interesting insight into the mechanics of how it actually unfolds.
Very much so. So you know that what you're watching is they're not selling it as magic, but what you're watching is you're watching, you know, people who are world leaders in their field. And what they're also telling you is, I think,
skillful.
Time and again, what they're telling you is that you can become that. You know, so it's not something that is, that's only available for the people who are born with it. That wonderful idea that, you know, capability and competence can be developed over time through practice and through experimentation and you know, success and failure and learning from failure, but you can achieve that. So, and leadership is just another one of those skills. You can learn how to be a, you know, you can say, oh, they're a born leader, which is great for them. But for the rest of us who aren't born leaders, there is an option, which is learn.
Is there a correlation? Because that idea of like being, say, a born leader, I've often correlated that same, I guess, interpretation of that with those people who appear to be like naturally good at certain like sporting skills. And I've sort of seen that like people, for example, in martial arts, like there's people who start at white belt and for whatever reason, just genetically or the fact that they've like watched heaps of Bruce Lee movies or something, I don't know, but they're just like naturally really good at certain sorts of things. But then it doesn't, but my observation is that it doesn't then necessarily always follow that then they become exceptional at martial arts. Like it does sometimes, but then there's this other element of like, I guess maybe you'd say like a willingness to learn, you know, if you're talking about, you know, leadership being a learned skill, would you think like my observation about like skills in general is there has to be outside of just learning, but there has to be like a real willingness to learn, like and to push past like that point where it's comfortable.
Yeah, look, I think you know, we're talking about, I suppose, dispositions, and you can have a disposition genetically, physically, intellectually towards something, and we probably all do have that. We have a genetic disposition towards that. However, that's the start. That's not the end game, and that's why, you know, you might say that you look at someone and go, oh, you know, look at them physically or intellectually or a combination of both. But what you don't see is the dedication and the, you know, the hard work and the reconciling failure and, you know, and celebrating success. You don't see that. You just see the outcome. So we tend to see things, you know, because we don't see time. We see, you know, we see a point in time. We don't see timelines. We see points in time. So we tend to think that that's how it is. And that's kind of how it always has been that way, you know. And for instance, if you've got family or friends and they've got children, and you don't see those children for some period of time, then you see them and they're fundamentally different. You kind of go, "Oh, look at you," you know, "you're different." But if you saw them every day, you would see the timeline of progression. You just see that point of time. Yeah, so
exactly,
it does certainly having a disposition towards something. Is beneficial at the beginning, but I don't think it's necessarily beneficial towards the end. And even that disposition doesn't even have to be, for instance, I suppose, inherited. So you can have exposures, or you can have learnings of relevant learnings. But if you don't allow those learnings to keep developing, you kind of get stuck in time. Mm. I remember, for instance, after I left school, I became an apprentice, and I was in a trade that was a pretty high tech trade, as it were. And you know, when we went to TAFE to do a block release, which is the way that they used to run it back then, so for 7 weeks every year you went to TAFE full time, so you became a full time student for 7 weeks. And once we got past a certain level of fundamentals within the trade that we're in, what became apparent is that a lot of the trade teachers didn't know as much as the emerging technology as the people who were there, because they learnt and refined their learning and then went to TAFE and into teaching. And it wasn't as a live environment as everyone who was coming in.
Mm.
So there was this kind of like, and you can imagine that once upon a time, they were probably, you know, the top tradesmen within their trade. And they said, oh, look, you come here and you train young people and make them better tradesmen. And there was probably a period of time where that worked. But over a period of time, if they didn't keep up or in actually try and stay in front of what was happening, there was this real, I suppose, disconnect. And so that can happen. So, for instance, in leadership roles, more than a couple of times I've coached people who have used a certain technique or a certain approach to get them to a point, but now they've actually found that that technique or that approach is no longer relevant because they're in a different environment.
Mm.
So, you know, it gets you a certain way, but they kind of mastered at level one, but now they're in level two, and level two is very different.
Yeah. Do you think that that's like some of that has to do with, like, say, with the example of if you're a teacher, there's like certain frameworks and restrictions placed upon you with the curriculum that you're given to teach, as opposed to then the person who's got the curriculum who they're given to teach, but they still actually are like maybe like more passionate, or their general predisposition is to like expand upon that even more, even though they've only been told to do like XYZ, that they're actually going to do more anyway. So, like, do you think my general observation, I suppose, too, is that some of that comes down to like people's general disposition about maybe how passionate they are, or that they feel, even though, like, say, like in your example, like they are behind the eight ball in terms of like current trends and everything else, that despite that, they're still going to try to inject something else into it anyway?
Yeah, well, I think that what that comes from is from a personal approach to learning. I think that it's you know, it's fundamental to have a personal approach to learning. Now, and I think the really important part of that is that it's personal. So you, how you like to learn, how you know, is really important to who you might be helping. But more importantly, it's more important to you. Mm. And so, you know, the sporting analogies are always, you know, a gold mine for coaching. So you look at someone like Jonathan Thurston. He played on the same field as everyone else, but he appeared to play it a different way.
Mm.
He still had the same rules, the same structures, you know, the distances, you know, the boundaries, the rules, the fundamentals were the same, but he seemed to play it a different way. And, you know, you get that. And so you also get this, what another sporting analogy I use is like someone like Mike Hussey, who, when he came onto the Australian international scene, it was like this revelation. This guy appeared out of nowhere, and he just came out of nowhere, and he was, you know, just having a fantastic batting average and all that stuff. The thing is, he didn't come out of nowhere. He'd been playing at what they call, you know, first class or level cricket for years on those same fields against the same players, but in a different situation. So really, for him, it was just he put a different hat on that day. But, you know, it was the same. It was, you know, he'd been constantly refining his skills and developing his skills and improving. And so it was just, oh, okay, I'm in a different role. And that's something that I often talk to people who are in senior or coming into a senior or even an executive or in some cases a CEO role, is that the best CEO in the world has something in common with the newest CEO in the world. And it's not the title CEO. It's the fact that both of them once upon a time in their life weren't a CEO.
Mm.
You know, you, no matter how good you are, there is a time in your life when you're not there.
Mm,
and, you know, exactly. And so technically on Sunday you go to bed and on Monday you wake up and you're the CEO. And so everyone has that transition. And so how you prepare yourself for that transition before you get to the transition is really important. So, you know, and that's some of those really, foundational leadership ideals of, you know, practice being a leader.
Yeah, well, there seems to be, there's an emerging sort of an emerging theme, which I suppose we could probably get your thoughts on other things that you like to do too. The theme being of sort of learning and like methods by which you actually, by willingness, how people learn, their learning style, and then I'd like say in the coaching sphere, in the executive coaching sphere, is it true to say that like from what you do with people, like the way you work, is it or I guess how important, I should ask, how important is it for you to identify like those methods by which people learn, like at an early stage?
Oh, most definitely. If we look at, indicators of success in terms of executive coaching, there's two that readily come to mind. Is one that I engage with this person as a person. I don't engage with them as, the chief executive officer, or I don't engage with them as the managing director of HR or something like that. I don't engage with that. They're the chief engineer or a title. I engage with them as a person, and understanding them as a person, and I suppose that, and over time developing a skill to be able to, at the very least, figure out quickly how to build connection with that person is vital. The second part of that, the other part of that two-part epoxy is that the person wants to learn. If the person doesn't, so when I look at coaching and I think about it, and I'm going to use another metaphor here because ultimately I think I'm a storyteller more than anything, is that when I look at how people approach or how people feel about, their development needs, there's an analogy I use, which is that it's about being lost. Mm. And if you think about it, we use the term I'm lost a lot, but, you might use it, for instance, you're in your car and you're driving in a new suburb. So they've opened up a whole new suburb behind where you live, and you go down to explore it, and you just kind of go, I don't know any of this. So technically you're lost, but then you see something. Maybe it's a geographic, it's a hill, it's a tower, it's something like that, or it's a street sign, but all of a sudden you go, oh, I know where I am now. And for a lot of people, their development is finding that point of reference. So they kind of go, I don't know really what to do here. And they kind of go, I'm lost. I'm like, oh, okay, now here's a point of reference. And so you can start on a point of reference. So helping that person is helping them identify that point of reference.
Yeah.
The second type of person is a person who just needs momentum, They need to move, And so because the path is not laid out in front of them, they've stopped. But the thing is, we know that often the best way to solve something is to start moving, because if you're moving, you can kind of go, well, maybe I'm not going the right direction, but now I can change because I've got momentum. So, it's a kind of...
At least then.
That's right. It's a learning and using feedback. You go, well, I thought I was going east, but really I'm not. But, you use feedback and you get more and more refined. The hardest person to connect with from a coaching point of view or from a learning point of view is a person goes, I know it. Yeah, I do that. Yeah, we do that. I've read that. So the person who says, no, everything's fine, that's actually the hardest person to breach. So from an executive coaching point of view, from a success point of view, the person that I'm coaching needs to want to be there. If it's not, it's some very uncomfortable time.
Yeah, no, well, I mean, that's I would imagine that everybody listening would just intuitively understand, like anyone that says, if if you're there, well, specifically if you're there to assist and then someone says, I don't need any assistance, you know, it's hard then to move forward. But I guess that gets back to just that general idea across just about, I think, you know, everything that I can think of, not just coaching or sport, but like, you know, lots of different activities is willingness. You know, you've got to have to be willing, like, to give it a go. And that's where I'm, like we were saying before, like the people who, I mean, this is, I know this is a bit of a broad brush to paint. It doesn't apply to everything, but I've often found, I mean, with myself, I suppose too, like, you know, but looking at other people, like people who are less, who say aren't as either genetically or just predisposed to something that they're good at, you know, who reach a certain point and they feel they don't have to try as hard, as opposed to somebody who's always had to struggle, and they've had to struggle and they've kept struggling because they got willingness to do that, are often going to be the people who, you know, actually succeed because they're going to stick it out, you know, in the long run, or they're going to be more likely to. It doesn't mean it's no answer that they're going to, but they might be more likely to. But then again, there's all sorts of shades of gray in that too. There's like people that are genetically, you know, or predisposed to something that are naturally good, who then become super successful because they're also like super motivated.
And so, well, I think it's always, you know, what we're looking at there is we're looking at the indicators or pillars of potential success.
Mm.
You have to do something with them. They in themselves won't do it. You know, they won't do it for you. So, you know, and I am sure that the history of, you know, any sport is littered with people who had the potential but didn't convert it for whatever reason. And, you know, they had everything, but they didn't actually have everything. So I'm sure that's the case. And I know for myself, and I think a big part of this again is what, and when I look at coaching and when I work with people, as a coach, I need to understand that, or I need to work a way to understand that, because I need to understand the person. Again, I need to focus on a person. But I know even for myself, the way you know, I usually say that it takes me about 10 years to get good at anything. You know, people say the 10,000 hour and things like that, they're all just ways of describing things. For me, it's about 10 years. And I can't remember his name for the life of me, but the actor, musician / comedian who played Kenny.
Kenny.
Yeah, the plumber. Oh, the, I can't oh, think. Shane, somebody.
Yeah,
he wrote a book. He wrote a book at something along the lines that, you know, it took me 10 years to be an overnight success, and that's kind of it. You know, I feel that in terms of personal professional development, we're talking about compounding interest. So you know, you've got to, you know, for a while it's cents, and then it gets to multiple cents, and then it gets to dollars, and then. And then it seems to accelerate, and I think that's what happens. You have compounding interest.
Yeah.
And so you've got to be willing to kind of, you know, like, as again, you know, when we were both kids, you know, and the Commonwealth Bank used to have a school account, and it was a dream that if you put in a tiny bit of money every week, eventually it would come true. Now, let's be honest, it probably didn't come true, but that was the dream, you know, the idea that this is a compounding outcome. If you keep going, you get better, and you know, and you become more aware of how you can deal with a challenge, and so when you get challenges, and this is an interesting sidebar, is that one of the big things that when I work with people in this space is that often people say that they lack confidence, or they use a word like confidence, you know, to describe the same thing. And even some people say, look, I believe that I suffer from imposter syndrome, which is a pretty topical, you know, idea. And along my journey, I studied psychology, specifically behavioral science. And one of the things I remember most from my psychology degree, other than the fact that I was in a room with people who were way smarter than me, was that don't make diagnoses. You know, your job is not to diagnose. Diagnosis and diagnostics is an art in itself, and you just don't see something and make a diagnosis. Because you're likely to misread it. And what I feel with things like imposter syndrome, and when someone says that, or they say, look, I think I suffer from imposter syndrome, or I'm not confident in my job or something like that, what you find is if you break that down and you say, okay, so let's talk about your job. So they go, okay, and I say, well, what do you do? And things like that. And we go, so I might say, so in your job, how much of your job is you're working on autopilot? That is, you've got no concern whatsoever that you will not achieve that particular outcome. Mm. And for most people who's been in a job for any period of time, that's like 80, 90% of their work.
Mm.
You know, they know 80, 90%. So I say, well, okay, so there's, and then I say, okay, so how much of your job is this is going to be damn hard, but we're going to make it. So, you know, we're going to work late, we're going to, you know, time frame's going to be compressed, we're going to come awfully close to cutting the budget, you know, we all would, you know, it's going to be tough, but we're going to make it. And, you know, it might be okay, it might be 5 to 10%. So immediately you get to the fact that for most people, about 90 to 95% of the time in their job, they know they're going to make it.
Mm.
So this time that they're an imposter is actually a very, very small part of their day or their week or their month or whatever the cycle of their work is. But the trouble is what we tend to do is we tend to disregard or devalue the measure of success that we have in our lives and overvalue, overemphasize and overmeasure those challenges.
What do you think that is?
There's lots of different reasons. I think it's a Western trait, you know, and especially I don't have a great deal of working experience overseas, but I know in Australia, you know, if you do something well, people go, yeah, you know, if you give someone a compliment, they'll go, yeah, whatever, yeah, it's my job, just doing my job, mate. Don't blow smoke on me. You know, we'll actually kind of not dislike it, but we mostly will devalue. That's what I do, mate.
Yeah, it's an implied. It's sort of this like implied thing that you're showing off, even though that's not spoken. Yeah. But it's like, don't worry about it. That's all right.
Yeah, that's all. You know, oh, mate, it's no big deal. It's my job. It's no big deal, mate. It's not big. So if someone, you know, if you're at a social event, and you know, someone does something at that social event and, the way they've set it up, something, you know, whatever it is, and you go, man, this is great fun. They go, yeah, you know, this is a normal Saturday type
thing. Yeah, let's do it all the time.
And you know it's not a normal Saturday. You know, these people, you know it's not. They've put effort, thought, you know, money, time, all into that to make it enjoyable, and it's worked. And you give them a compliment on that, and they just kind of turn a little bit to the side and brush it off. Now, if the event didn't work, and I don't mean like catastrophically didn't work, but it just didn't come off as they envisioned it, they'd chew over that for days, if not weeks. You know, they're like, oh, you know, I should have done this, I should have done that. And this, A should have been before B, and D should have been before one. You know, and that's what we do. We do that at work. So, you know, most people I speak to are people in executive roles. And unless it's a situational coaching, and I'll explain that. So generally coaching either follows two formats. What's called a situational coaching, like something has gone wrong and I've been asked to come in to talk to someone. But that's actually a very, very small component of my gig.
Mm.
Nearly always it's someone is doing something well and we want them to do something better. Okay.
And so it might be expand upon what they're
good at. We've promoted person A to a new role and we want you to help them master the role like they mastered the previous ones. So that's a developmental coaching approach. Okay. So there's situational and developmental. Now, 95% of the people I coach are in a what you might call the developmental pillar or pipeline. Very few times do I coach people in the situational one. Now, by the fact that I've walked into by the fact that an organization has engaged me to talk to you, tells me that you're pretty good at your job. So even now I know, before I even lay eyes on you, that you're, you know, you're at about 80% at least in terms of success. So if you're in a job and you're holding that job and no one, you know, you're not in a position where you may lose that job because of your performance, conversely, if that's the case, then you're probably doing at least an 80%. You're hitting 80%. Now, you go, well, I should be hitting 100% or 90%. But if you think about 80%, 80% is a chunk of stuff. You know, it's a big chunk of measurement of performance. So most people are doing that. Most people are acting at a pretty high level to start with.
That's why they're there in the first place.
But for us, that's that, unfortunately, the way, you know, we think, that becomes baseline. That becomes baseline. And so if I'm not at 80%, you know, I'm not performing. So you kind of invariably shift your own baseline on yourself, and so you get to a point where maybe your measures of yourself or the measures of what you see and do might be a little bit unrealistic for yourself.
In the sense that your standards increase once you reach the next level.
Yeah, that's right. So as something becomes, you know, easier for you, you know, you invariably kind of the baseline rises.
Yeah, I guess there's a, it just sort of occurred to me, I'm thinking about a sport metaphor, but once again, I think it applies to this too, that if you've reached a certain level, you know, say if we use a metaphor of like a video game, you reach a certain standard and you've worked like very, very hard to reach that level and you know you're able to do it, but then you haven't done it enough that you can consistently perform yet at that same level over and over and over again. So like you, in your mind, you're like, I'm at this level. So would you say, or what's your view on, say, people who have reached a certain standard and mentally they're like, I'm here, but then is there more frustration and anxiety that creeps in then when people, you know, say shortly after they aren't quite as good at that level as they thought they were, but mentally they're like, I'm here now, but they... it's more frustrating, which I guess would make sense, unless you've been then at that level for X amount of years or months and you're consistently good at those particular skills or whatever it is that, you know, that maybe wouldn't require someone like you to assist them, like in that context. I'm like, what do you think about that? Is there even more frustration that creeps in? And is that consistent across the board, or is that like with only certain sorts of people?
Look, I think again, it comes down to the individual, but there is certain kind of themes that run through that. And one of the key themes is that we're really terrible at measuring ourselves. Because we have to, you know, we have to live with it. So we're really terrible at it. Yeah. You know, we're the person we speak to the most, you know, and, you know, so we tend to, everything for us is outward, except for when we actually consciously or subconsciously think about ourselves. But that's not a particularly effective measure. That's not a good way of measuring something. You know, we know that if we want to measure something, objectivity in the measurement is the most important thing. Yeah. Because if it isn't, then we kind of go, oh, you know, like if someone creates a survey and we, you know, if you know, let's look at some of the historical stuff. You know, like the smoking lobby produces documentation that smoking is good for you. Smoke it three times a day, and you know, we know.
Well, you mean it's not?
We know that that's. We know that's. What? That's it. We know that there is a. You know, we know that it's wrong. You know, so if and or when someone does a report and you read it and it's you know it's. You know, like political commentary that you see now, you know, more and more in the online print media, you know. So this article bashes one political party and you get down to the bottom and it's written by someone else in the other political party. And we go, oh, come on. We're kind of the same, you know. We know that if we really want to measure something, we have to be objective. The trouble is when we measure ourselves, we're not objective. Mm. You know, we're the least objective person. So it's really important, no matter how you measure those things, that you get objective, you get input from others or from other sources that helps balance that. You know, so you cannot be the arbiter of your own performance. You have to get, and one way of doing that is actually to recognize other things around you. So, you know, actually recognizing, you know what? When such and such said to me that I did a good job, maybe they meant it. you know, maybe they were actually telling the truth. And that's why I think it's so important. And I did this today. Just it's so important that if you hear someone praising someone, obviously for a good thing, you know, that you not only you actually go back to the person who is giving the praise and give them praise for doing it. Mm. So today I literally went to I was at a board meeting and I went to one of the board members and say, hey, look, one of the team was really chuffed that you recognized them in that meeting last week to make it kind of ubiquitous and that no one could identify the conversation. And I already knew that the person who received the feedback glowed when they got feedback because they told me, but also the person, you know, when the person who gave that initial feedback heard that, they also glowed too, you know. Mm. So it's really important that when someone gives praise and you secondhand learn of that, to actually praise the person who did it because it's so easy to do and it is so fundamentally influential. It's, you know, allowing someone to hear that they've done a good job and then even their acts, you know, in any way, so even if their action is to praise others, is fundamental. So when you're measuring yourself, and look, we do a number of the coaching assignments we do, we'll do a like a baseline type of 360-degree test type thing, you know. And some people by their very nature, you know, are harsh markers, and some people are more, you know, generous markers. And when you talk to those people, and this is either about themselves or about other people, the harsh markers say like, you know, I do it for encouragement. Okay. And when you talk to the people who may be on the other side, who are maybe, you know, a little too much praiseworthy, you ask them what they do. I do it for encouragement. Mm. You know, I gave him a hard mark because I want to motivate him. I gave him a great mark because I want to motivate him. You know, and that's
it's
the thing.
It's kind of not really objective, then, is it?
No, not at all.
No,
but you got it. So when you measure yourself, if you're measuring yourself. And one of the things I say to people is, so if someone has a report and we go through the report and at the end of it, I can see they're a little perplexed and, you know, because there's a really, really, they've really slammed themselves. And that's often the case. So you, with a 360, I'm not sure if you understand a 360, but you know, it's different inputs around. It's the same questions put to different people. So you get like themes. So it might be your manager, it might be your customers, it might be your peers, it might be the people you report to, but part of it's you as well. So there's all these trend lines. And someone who's on a bottom of the trend line or someone in the top of the trend. So when people are kind of in the middle, they're okay. You know, oh, well, I'm kind of in the middle. But if they're at the top, they go, oh, maybe I'm too soft on myself. And, you know, or on the trend, maybe I'm too hard on myself. And I say to them, it's the same thing. It's the same with any kind of praise. It's the same thing. if by being hard on yourself, you find that motivates you to greater outcome or success, that's a great thing. If you feel that giving yourself praise motivates you to greater outcomes and greater success, that's a great thing. But if either too high or too low gets in the way, then you need to think about that. Mm-hmm. So if too high means that you have expectations that aren't realized, you need to think about that. If too low means you don't take a chance because you believe your expectations will not be realized, you need to think about that.
Mm.
You don't want your measures to get in your way. You want your measures to motivate.
There's an awful lot of, sounds like there's an awful lot of psychology involved in sort of, but at the end of the day too, I guess it's just a lot of sort of observation and understanding about people too, you know, at the heart of all these things. Yeah. It's like people are, you know, there's like such a wide gamut of different sorts of people, people's, you know, and all the combinations of their motivations, their upbringing and any number of things. But, you know, at least if you can get to the heart of certain things, you know, creating, like you were saying before, like you feel like you're describe yourself as a storyteller, which I find really interesting too, that I know you're you can tell people a little bit about like some of your writing and involvement with various magazines too. So like in not only in the context of like actual writing, but like the storytelling of weaving a story, maybe even like it just sort of occurred to me that there's an element of just think of the right term, like almost co-creation of a story, maybe as a coach, because you're involved in somebody's story and you're assisting them, like not a equal level of co-creation, but because you're then injecting yourself as like a character, like inside their story, you know, in a way, like a metaphor like that. No, because
I'm liking it a lot.
There's nothing like a good metaphor.
Oh, no, right now. And I have to admit, I'm known for them.
Yeah, I am too. Yeah, I maybe like from, you know, metaphors, as far as I'm concerned, like most design and art is like they're flying around everywhere. You can't get rid of the damn things. They're like buzzing around like flies, like metaphors everywhere. But like that idea of you saying you feel like you're, you know, being like a storyteller, I found really interesting because people often associate that, and that's like a real catch phrase right now in the branding and design industries, this idea of storytelling. And it should be, rightly so. I mean, it's true, but it's used. But you saying it is interesting because like I know that you, I never really, I guess, made the connection between like your interest in writing, obviously about something that you really, I mean, I love when it comes to like the hunting and that whole sort of industry. And then like the fact that you obviously like telling those stories and sharing them with people and talking, and I guess like sort of in a way, because stories are reliving experiences too. But then if you can participate in somebody else's story, it's, I mean, I always found it's, you know, incredibly rewarding, helping anyone out. But in a way that is like you're injecting yourself, like I'm another little character who's playing this role in your story. And that can like end up like going down any number of narratives, you know, or one usually, but sometimes, you know, it goes down some other path, it's unexpected. And that's exciting too. I mean, I always really like that. But do you want to tell people a little bit about...
Oh, well, I think, well, yeah, I'm just processing what you said, to be honest. But look, I suppose to give that some context of what you just said then, I think for me, storytelling is the mechanism. What I really like about working with people in coaching, but more broadly I've found throughout my life, is I like seeing people succeed. So sometimes I give them ideas about success mechanisms. So you might achieve it through this way. But for some people, it's about allowing them just to see the opportunity for success. So, but for me, what I get, I've never particularly wanted to be out front. So, but I get great joy in seeing people succeed. So there's that. That's kind of, I think, where the coaching comes from. The behavioral science, I think, is just giving, has given me, and practicing that behavioral science for a number of years has just given me a refinement of skill. But ultimately, the way in which I do help people is I try to weave a story, and I try to weave a story that they're the character. So, you know, I'm not a narrator by any means, but I want them to see themselves as the lead within their journey. I want them to see that what they're doing is actually directly contributing to their success. So I don't want anyone to think, oh, my success came from someone else. Now, it obviously it does, but I don't want them to disregard their own part in that journey. So I don't want them to kind of feel that, oh, it's, you know, and that gets back to that original idea about magic, you know, in that, you know, the way that we see magic is that some people are born with it, which is great, unless you're not. So what I want to say is that it doesn't matter. That doesn't matter as much as what you envisage and what you want to strive towards and what you want to drive towards. So I think that's a big part of it. Now, I suppose more broadly in the storytelling world, there's, you know, there's lots and lots of parts in my life where that kind of, I suppose, again, getting back to those idea of measures, when I look back and kind of go, okay, that's what you're doing. So it's a pretty, you know, if you follow your own bias, you're probably a storyteller because, boy, you're telling stories all the time. So, you know, and it energizes me rather than it draws upon my energy, which is always also a really good a good way to determine if you really like something. If you feel that it drains you, you probably don't like it. If you feel that it energizes you, it's probably good. And so people,
that's a good measure.
Know, that's it. So what energizes you and what drains your energy? So for me, a big part of what energizes me is that I've, for as long as I can remember, always wanted to live an outside life. And I have done that for a big chunk of my life. You know, even from, you know, a very early age, I've been outside and I've been exploring and I've been doing. And it's not because my family were, you know, came from a family. It was always something that drove myself. And one of the big things that I, for whatever reason, and this is very difficult to explain, I can give justifications for it, but I don't ever think they explain the why, is that I felt a strong connection to the outside world through hunting. And people often are a bit shocked by that. One, because hunting is not such a thing that we think about anymore, though, you know, that's only a fairly recent thing in the history of the world. But the thing is, I have, for a long time now, I've hunted, and about 2008, I was literally reading a magazine. And they said, yeah, you know, tell us about your hunting stories. And I wrote a story and it went from there. And over that period of, again, so what that's 15 years, So there's that model of success that takes at least 10 years. I've become more and more one is I've become a better writer, and two, I've become more well-read. And so I'm published regularly. And now most recently I've picked up a column. I replaced the gentleman who retired after 35 years in a magazine called Australian Shooter, and I'm now the back page column. So I've started the back page column. So I'm now, for that period of time up to this year, I've been what's a freelance. So I write and I submit. That has, that went from, for a period of time, I think I was like getting published once a quarter for about 7 years to, maybe 20, 30 articles a year across the spread of magazines, both in Australia and
still a fair amount of articles, like 20,
and,
30 articles.
And globally, globally.
Fair amount.
Yeah. Again, so using my own measures, I'm probably a storyteller.
I tend to see if I was going to say, not that I ever think that's about myself, but just when we're talking about this, if someone was to say, hey, Saul, like, what's your like superpower, or what do you think you're, kind of good at? I feel like maybe even things that I'm good at noticing. Like I noticed straight away by things that you were talking about, there's this very clear link between, an approach then to executive coaching and then other things you do, and would be, I'm making assumptions here, but that's like something, one, that you really like doing, and that's like, kind of core to your, things that you obviously enjoy, things that you're, a lens through which like you look at things, and look at the world. And I mean, I certainly relate to that too, because that's like, everyone loves a good story. That's universal. That's kind of, I think most people would agree if said, everyone likes a good story, they're probably like, yeah, that's pretty true. It's why people like movies. It's why a good, well-defined, thing with meaning and passion. I mean, it doesn't have to have those things, but, it brings meaning to living and to things. It's why, it's why I think generally podcasts have this amazing sort of popularity now. And there's, and some people, you hear this opinion around that there's that like audio and listening to podcasts specifically is taking over more popular than watching, or like watching and listening, because one, there's kind of an element of convenience, but you have these long form conversations that in themselves weave a story in a way that you can't, that you, well, not that you couldn't, but that you in an organic fashion, in a different manner to something else that is either scripted or, it sort of has this flow, but it becomes its own story just by the nature of how it's happening. And that's got a completely different interest factor to people, because it's like you're sitting in with them in their conversation. And I find that really fascinating. And that's why. And yeah, I can only say that's why I like listening to podcasts that I listen to, is because it feels like you're in the same room with those people and they're...
Yeah, if it's an inviting podcast, and obviously there's prerequisites on, content and things like that.
Yeah, it's not every podcast.
That's right. But it certainly, if it works, it feels like you are... And I mean, so as you know, so... I suppose to pivot back to the storytelling. So I've been writing since 2007. I've got every behind me here is every magazine I've ever been published in, and it's well over 100 now.
Oh, nice.
And more recently I've got into video and still photography was a huge part of that initial stage. What interesting though, after about 10 years in, I stopped taking photos of myself. And I noticed that the later articles very rarely features me. They feature the people I'm with or something like that. There is actually, you know, it's not, I'm not, it's funny because I'm not in them almost type thing. You know, so that's obviously a slow progression there. But, you know, look, so if you look at my writing, so at base level, I do things like reviews, equipment, and so on and so forth. I do stories like hunting stories, or I do observational pieces of something like that. But what I try to do and everything I try to do is I try to have a story in that. So so sometimes my reviews have been criticized because they're not techie enough. But to me, you can find that anywhere. So I try to write a story about a review. But one of the great things that's come about after that this period of time is I'll get people who I don't know, and I will literally run into them on the street and they'll go, "You helped me do something. You know, I wanted to try this. I didn't know how to try it. I read you and you helped me do it." And what that gave an idea to a couple of years ago was a good friend, Ian Hurley, and another friend, Jonathan Steele. We started something called the Hunter's Campfire, which is a YouTube channel and a Facebook page and an Instagram account. And what we did was we're all kind of the same idea, is that it's this concept of that you're sitting around a fire and you're discussing things, you're talking things, and you know, and it is a campfire, so there's a bit of bravado because that's what happens around a campfire, and there is a bit of, you know, wordplay, but there is what it is mostly or ultimately is there is a lot of discussion and learning and reflection and things like that. And so our approach has been to create this thing called the Hunter's Campfire, where if you don't know or you're unsure, you can go and have a look and go, okay, that might help me start. And we've, like last year, we actually kind of did a, for the Facebook page, if you look at the Facebook page, you'll see that the banner image is all these different photos of people. And there's Ian, John, and myself, the three of us are in those photos, but everyone else is people we've helped that year.
Right.
So, and that's their success. And it's like, yeah, that's what we want to hear. We want to hear about your success. So again, even in that instance, I'm storytelling. I'm telling stories about what I did, how I might go about it, what I learned from it, and things like that. So that storytelling theme runs through all that. The rationale behind hunting is much harder for me to adequately describe. And you know, as I said, often in it, because it's seen often as a controversial thing, which is odd. But anyway, I try not to dwell on that. Is that you tend to get into a conversation about why you do it. So you know it's you know, you, because it's feral pests in Australia, so you're helping the natural environment. There's the, you know, there's the food part, so you know you're not relying on supermarkets for meat and things like that, and you're gaming outside, and there's lots of psychological studies that say it's actually, you know, it's how beneficial it is psychologically for you, and all these kind of things about, you know, challenging yourself and setting plans. But all of those are rationalizations. They don't actually describe the why, and for me that's very difficult. Even if someone wants to be, you know, and I've had it more than once before, someone wants to, you know, say something a little unkind and says, "Oh, well, you know, it's just bloodlust." Well, the reality is hunting on foot in a state forest or on public land is probably the least effective way to actually find an animal. It's like, you know, it's so difficult, which is a great attractant to it, that, you know, it kind of negates all those silly kind of statements. But as you may imagine, I wrote a little about the thought process recently, and there was this, there was a meme on Facebook, and of course memes describe everything in our lives now, and there was this meme, and it's that, you know, that television show, Family Ties.
Yeah.
You obviously know. The father.
Oh, with Michael Family J. Fox Ties. Originally.
Yeah. No, the father. Yeah, Michael J. Fox, but the father, really tall guy.
Yeah.
He did a movie later on called Tremors, which was this really kind of spoofy science fiction thing.
I think I vaguely remembered that.
Yeah, and he plays this kind of survivor nut up in the hills, you know, in America, you know, and his life is guns and flags and stuff, and he helps fight this monster because, you know, he's armed to the teeth.
Of course.
So it's a photo of him in that character, so he's got a big, you know, cheesy moustache type thing. And there's him, and then there's a photo of geese on the wing, and they're honking, and then the next photo is he's looking up, you know, his eyes are up, and then there's a question that says, you know, what are you listening to? And he answers smiling, nothing. And that resonated with me because, and this is really hard to explain, is that the natural world exists without our knowledge and without our consent. And if you're lucky enough to see that or hear that, you realize there is something greater than you know, the urban environment. There is a thing out there that is far greater than the urban environment, which is the natural world. And more importantly, the natural world isn't like it's not like our version of animals. It's not like we control it and so we create it. It actually exists without, you know, it exists. Aldo Leopold, who is a famous and fundamentally, you know, one of the foundational writers of conservation, wrote this piece on extinction once, and he wrote it about a type of pigeon in the US that was shot to extinction. They thought they would never end, and guess what? They did. They killed them all. And they've actually, in this particular town, they built this monument to the pigeon. And he's talking about that, and he said, the reality is, if it happened to us, the pigeons wouldn't build a monument to us. And it was, but you know, it was, they don't really, the natural world doesn't really have much concern for us other than, you know, one, that to keep our eye on our predaceous nature and also to, you know, take opportunity from us when we can. But they do their thing. So birds don't tweet for us. Birds tweet for a wholly different reason. And if you're able to find that, and I found that hunting has allowed me to do that because you're so immersed, so immersed in it, that it's fundamentally changing the way you see things.
Is it true? Because I mean, I've as like somebody, because I should say, like for people listening, I'm not a hunter. I'm not into the same sort of things, but it's, for me, it's not anything like, I feel like I do certainly understand like some of the reasons why people do it. I guess maybe some of that has been helped a little bit by listening to people like, you know, Joe Rogan too, who's obviously a, like he speaks about that a lot. But I mean, I feel like I understand what you're saying. I mean, outside of the fact that animals like pigeons couldn't actually make a monument, a monument anyway, with their little wings, but
well, they could make a monument. But that could be a big pile of pigeon poo.
Yeah, that's right. We just wouldn't realize it's a monument.
That's right. Well, we wouldn't be here to see it. So that was the point.
Yeah, that's right. We'd all be dead because they, I mean, will have hunted us to extinction. But like the fact, but yeah, it's I think from a human experience point of view, like whilst I can't say that I've had that same experience that you kind of is hard to put into words, I feel like I have had it through other experiences, certainly in nature, especially on our sort of property too. I was actually just talking about this with my wife the other day. We were talking about like this, like even probably in a less extreme sort of manner than what you're talking about. But when you're like nearer to nature and just things from anything from the firsthand experiences you have with the outside environment, to like the lack of comfort that you're used to in an urban environment, to being like stung by or bitten by animals that you would usually not, you know, have those experiences with. It just expands, for me anyway, it sort of expands, like being someone who loves, you know, animals and nature in general, just the whole shebang. But also, I guess it's kind of this contradiction that I feel like a lot of people have between that you can only love and experience it if you have the perspective that nature is, I'm sure there's plenty of unphilosophical writings on this, that, you know, nature is pure and sort of fundamentally kind of like good, and that we're bad, you know, as opposed to the perspective that, you know, it doesn't have to be one or the other, that there's a lot of, you know, like I've observed all the times, like we've been into insects and ants and various things, and you look at the insect world, like, which is like amazing, it is incredibly cool, like observing ants, and then I look at the fact that I can like mow over a gigantic meat ant nest, which is huge, which is like this colony, this ravenous colony of ants, and they seem to disappear, and then a short amount of time they come back, and you look closely and they've been like rampaging over the whole yard, grabbing, you know, little worms and things and bringing them back in, and they're, you know, wholly ravenous because that's what they do. And it's not, and our projection onto that is, you know, we don't take it the same way as like maybe other mammals or things, like a bear hunting a person. But like you look at it closely, and there's all these sort of similar correlations, and it's incredibly interesting, but also incredibly brutal. There's, you know, these sort of aspects, and I feel like it's people often need to be, they feel like they've got to sit on one side of the fence or the other, and they have to take a stance on it. I mean, I don't know. Like, do you feel like that's
almost definitely, like, so even by the fact that we're talking about hunting, there's going to be people who are listening who are going to draw conclusions from that. And
yeah, no doubt.
And once upon a time, I suppose present this in such a way to say that I could defend that, but I've come to the point of realization that that's probably not so important. You know, getting back to your point about good and bad, the interesting thing is good and bad is our projection onto that world. You know, there isn't, we do that. We project the purity of nature and the evilness of man, or vice versa, and, you know, something like that. What my observations have been is that these things don't exist. For instance, in Queensland, we have a red deer population, which is seen as a pest animal. It was introduced in the 1800s. It was a gift from Queen Victoria to Queensland, and the fact that it was New South Wales probably at the time, it was still a part of New South Wales. Mm. And they were released into the wilds, and they survived. And if you think about that, that's, you know, like climate change, like we've never experienced ever. You know, you're in a mountain in Scotland, someone throws a net over you, you're in a box, and you wake up in the Brisbane Valley. Now, hang on.
Surprise.
But what's happened is more fundamentally interesting is that, you know, they, within a very short period of time, reset their whole breeding cycle to be 180 degrees out of the previous breeding cycle, and so they survived. So they started doing what they do, and they've done that at least from the end of the Ice Age. But a part of that cycle is what's called a roar, where the stags vocalize, they roar amongst other things for dominance to attract hinds. And what happens is, in a stag's life, for about 10 and a half months, you're a bachelor and you hang out with other stags, and, you know, you kind of wander around, and, you know, you, you do what stags do. And then for about six weeks of the year, you try to kill each other. You literally try and kill your best mate for a competition for mates.
Sounds familiar.
But it's only it happens every year, and it's funny. So it does that. But if you're lucky enough to hear those roars, which I am, and they're going to start up in about 4 to 5 weeks, you realize that what you're hearing is something that has absolutely nothing to do with you.
Mm.
No matter how important you feel that you are as a human, it's nothing to do with you. You are an intruder. You're an interloper. And when you hear that and you hear the responses to it, you actually kind of it's fundamentally changing, because it doesn't matter if I'm here or not. This is not happening for my amusement, my pleasure, my learning or anything. It's actually nothing to do. I'm not even a blip on the radar. So hearing that is, and that's a part of what you experience. So much so that, and that is from a hunting point of view, that's peak hunting time. That is the peak hunting time. Why? Because deer who are otherwise described as ghosts of the forest become, goofy idiots. So they actually become quite easy to hunt. And I have on numerous occasions been sitting there in a paddock on dawn, and gone, I'm not going to hunt today. I'm just going to listen to this. Because there is something happening around me that is fundamentally bigger than me, in that it's not even bigger than me. It's actually just something that's happening. It's a wheel that's spinning that I have no influence over whatsoever.
It's like when you hear something for the first time, like I've heard a lot of, any range of birds, of which I don't really know offhand any of their actual proper bird names, but the ones that are especially at night, for some reason there's various birds like out on our property, and I heard one the other night and it was just really, I don't know what sort of bird it was, but it was like really, really eerie, but it was this amazing sound. This is really shrill, and was so loud because everything, because especially where we are, like there's some surrounding mountains, and sound seems to echo like really powerfully. And I'm sure it wasn't anywhere near the house, but there's like something about the connection. Like you said, like it's got nothing to do with you, but your mind, or at least like mine does anyway, it's like wondering what's the purpose, like is it
that's what we do.
Why are they doing it?
We try to interpret it. We try to kind of go,
of course we do.
It's a mating call, or it's a it could be something fundamentally different to our interpretation. And then we'll convince ourselves, oh, that's a Yellow Belly sapsucker, and it's currently talking to its mate,
might be.
You think that's not, it might be, but it might not be. And that's the whole, a great example of that is the laughing kookaburra. And if you know anything about kookaburras, they're not laughing. That's actually a territorial statement. So they're not laughing at all. They're actually saying, hey, you go away.
Yeah.
But we call it laughing. So, that's a kind of, a great way of describing it. When I talk to people that I describe, that kookaburra, the laughing kookaburra, it's not laughing.
Yeah,
that's what we call it. We call it laughing. It's not laughing at all.
It's territorial. Like we're just relating.
That's right. We just relate it, and I think sometimes that what we do is we over relate. So we think, no bird chirps for us. No, they don't do it for us. If we weren't there, they'd be chirping. If we're there, we're chirping. They might stop when they see us because they think, oh, predator. They might go, oh, hang on, but they don't do it for us. And I think that's what I suppose my outdoor life has allowed me to be part of. That,
it's really interesting. Like I said before, I could never see myself, doing hunting or anything like that, but I do, in one sense, like I do feel like I understand certainly why, I mean, someone like yourself, or I mean, not everyone, because I know there's probably people who hunt for other, I mean, reasons too. You know, they and I mean, some of it, I mean, like I wouldn't know because I don't know anyone. I mean, I like that, but I mean, people do things for all sorts of reasons, you know, and what they do is their own business. But I mean, I can only sort of relate to probably very logical, practical things too. I mean, it's certainly, you know, it's, I'm sure, like if you look at most people's perspective on like the cane toad is like, the cane toad was introduced. It's like super hardy. Most people don't have, I mean, this is, some people probably disagree. I mean, I've never done any like great harm to a cane toad because I haven't been hunting them. I haven't been like hunting down cane toads, but most people don't, like with a cockroach, they don't have a particularly fond view of the cane toad as opposed to their dog. You know,
no, well, there is.
I'm gonna look after the cane toad. If if they saw a cane toad that had sort of transpired, they're not going to be, oh, you know, really sad about that. You know, but the fact is that there's, you know, things happen within nature that, you know, I mean, our nature is predisposed to, you know, feeling certain ways about some things. The more relatable, I was actually just talking about this to son the other day. We were talking about fish. I was saying, and I just sort of had this idea and I posed it to him. I said, do you think, it was sort of a creepy question, or he thought it was creepy because then he was imagining like a smiling fish. I said, like if fish had more expressive qualities, like, you know, say like other mammals or other animals that people relate to more, do you think people would be less inclined to fish if they caught a fish and they saw and the fish was able to like express more pain or like anguish on his face? And then it was like, well, I think it'd be really creepy like to catch a fish and see it smiling at you or like crying. But well, yeah, it would, but the point was that, you know, not really that, but that our interpretation of things in general is like so closely related to our own worldview. Like we can't separate ourselves from that. You know,
it's, no, it's we like, can't. I mean, and
it's like inextricably linked.
One of the things that I've given up, and I, not because I gave it up because of I felt that I didn't have the right approach, but one of the things I've given up is one of the troubles with this is that it, because it's controversial and people, or it can be controversial, it's not always, there's a lot of, look, around the world, there's a lot of places where this is completely normal behavior. Mm-hmm. And I always laugh when people say things like, you know, well, let's be more like Norway. Well, in Norway, you can hunt whale. So do you want to be like, you know, in Norway, you're able to legally hunt moose by driving them with a dog. So, you know, we do that thing where we kind of, we shop for the answer we want. But a couple of points is that, one, when we talk about, so when I talk about hunting, I'm talking about hunting on foot for a particular species of game. And my, even as a very experienced hunter, my strike rate is probably 60%. So then you have things like pest eradication. So, and this is for many people, this is what they see hunting, is that there's a feral population on a property, goats, pigs, whatever it is, foxes, rabbits, and there's a, you know, a wholesale destructive effort. Now, I don't do that, not that I don't do it because I think it's fundamentally wrong or something like that. It's just not, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the more immersive approach to a particular single animal, which I am hoping, and climactic conditions play a part of this, to actually harvest meat from that animal. Now, I don't do it because for that that is not the sole reason. That's just one of the benefits of it. Another benefit is that it actually does help maintain species populations on public and private land. But they're all kind of the benefits, and I don't want to get
well. It's interwoven. Yeah, no,
that's right. So that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about a very particular activity. But there is, the word hunting is shooting, because often not always there's trapping and there's poisoning and there's all sorts of ways that we kill animals that we don't like. There's a whole reamer that we're quite good at it. But there's those kind of components. And so for me, it has become over time very much a philosophical idea. That's why it's almost very difficult for me to properly put it into words, which is probably one of the reasons why I write stories about it, because it's easier for me to do that than try to express the reasoning, philosophical reasoning behind it. But to your point about fish and all those kind of things, there's so many variables in that. It's how you're brought up. It's what you experienced as an adult. It's how you understand about food, where food comes from. There's so many variables in that. And then you get cultural variables. There's places in the world where they eat animals that we don't want to eat.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And we kind of go, oh, is that horrible? They're eating that animal, but they're not eating that animal. So it's a complex. Well, it's a human. It's a human. It's
and then human. There's cannibals obviously.
There's what?
Yeah, and then there's people, although probably not that many of them around, people that eat other people too.
Well,
as cultural, that's another thing altogether.
Yeah, I'm assuming that culturally that is on the decline, but.
Yes.
I mean, yes, if you do love your. Your sci-fi, you understand about things like Soylent Green, and things like that.
Strangely enough, but sort of ironically, I'm sure that's true, but you wouldn't know it. Like if an alien came to Earth and saw the amount of like zombie movies that people see, they'd probably be like, wow, that's like a pretty common thing, because there's heaps of like weird looking people like eating other people. So you'd be thinking that's probably pretty normal. Like if that was one of the first pieces of fiction you came across, you'd probably like, oh, they're obviously obsessed by eating each other, which isn't the case at all.
Or at least being chased by others who want to eat you.
Yeah. Who are
it appears to be
seemingly impervious.
The chases are fudge. It appears as an alien from the movies, it would appear from the documentation of your planet's life, it would appear that the people who are doing the chasing are much more enthusiastic about it than the people that are being eaten.
Yeah, but
not sure why that is.
However, our general observations, like outside of this fiction that you're showing, is we can't really seem to find the zombies, so they must be living underground.
Well, they must be seasonal. We just come at the wrong time. It's like seasonal.
Yeah, that's right. They're like spread out of the ground.
We'll be back next year. When should we return? What, April, May? When's the best time to see this?
Yeah, but it's like a funny. it's always funny. Saying things like that, but the reality is too that like we all make our I'm sure I do, you make all sorts of like broad judgments about things, and you go, I'm pretty open-minded, and then you reflect on it and you go, like, I always thought this, and then someone's like, you're saying about like kookaburras, it's a very like generally culturally in Australia, it's like a really pleasant, like, oh wow, it's so great. It sort of sounds really nice. I heard them the other day. It's like, oh, it's nice waking up in the morning to the kookaburras. But then the context is waking up. Yeah, it's like waking up in the morning. Well, but the kookaburras waking up in the morning to a bunch of guys fighting like in their yard. Right. And going, oh wow, that's such a, I love the sound of all those men fighting.
That's right. Yeah. It's the dulcet tones of my neighbors fighting.
Yeah, yeah. Of people screaming. And they go, oh, that's awesome. I love that. It makes me feel relaxed.
So there's that wonderful interpretation, and we may very well be wrong about that interpretation, but after a while it becomes accepted fact, and then we're happy with it.
Yeah, but you certainly, like, people see what they want to see. I saw, thanks to the internet, yet again for showing me sort of rubbish that I'm not searching for, but still ends up being interesting, is I saw that snippet in a video of the thing, which you may have seen. There's a bunch of different samples of like images of the same image, but children see a bunch of dolphins, and adults see two like lovers.
I have not seen that.
Yeah, there's a bunch of different things. And the point was that it's obviously, I think they're tools, psychological tools too. And I've seen these a few times, but this particular one was, they were saying, like, as an adult, you can't see the dolphins. And I was and you can't even see the dolphins. But I was actually trying to see the dolphins because, of course, the video was saying I was an adult and that I couldn't see them. So I was trying to see them. And I actually couldn't see them. I was like, but children then do the opposite. They can't see the two people, embracing, but they just see only dolphins.
Well, that's what they've told you kids can see, because you can't actually see that and so on. So
you're saying it's a conspiracy.
It could just be fraud. No, conspiracy is, it could just be fraud. I think that if we're going to give some kind of structure to this, that perception is incredibly influential, and how we perceive things, either ourselves or those around us, may give us an anchor on which to, we can go forward. But that's not necessarily a true anchor, but it's still, we use it as such. So, and that we get into bias and really interesting conversations about bias, which I think is, it's certainly, unfortunately, taken in many cases a negative connotation. But I think understanding bias is really, really important. Mm. And understanding why you have certain biases and what those biases are really important. And again, I think that this is whole conversation's about. Part of that is, what is your bias? How do you see it, and why do you see it? And understanding what that is.
Some of that, then, I guess, especially this part of the conversation that we've been having about hunting, then too. But even like any opinion that, say, you or I share that someone else doesn't share, then part of, say, if you want to say, either if there's any reason to have a reconciliation on that, or even maybe to very, very broadly, with the risk of sounding wishy-washy, to make the world a better place, like that somebody else, like part of that has to be that a person listening in to someone else sharing an opinion has to have, first and foremost, a willingness to listen. Yeah. And yep. it gets back to like the willingness thing we were talking about before, is that like you can't move forward with anything unless there's at least, okay, I'm willing to listen to something that my bias says I currently hate, or I currently think is like evil, or I currently think is great that somebody else thinks is not great. If you can at least go, where are they coming from? It doesn't mean, as that assumption then too, that conversation would mean that you're leading to you changing your opinion, but it doesn't have to be that. Like, it's just that it might open up another perspective that you didn't have. You might still have the same opinion, but it means that you maybe got a little bit closer to having more insight, like, into the other person's story.
Yeah, I think what the takeaway from that is, and something that I've thought about is, and in reflective of a lot of things, is you don't have to be your opinion. Your opinion doesn't necessarily have to be your who you are. You know, you're a persona, however you want to describe that. You don't have to be that opinion. You can have an opinion. You don't have to be that opinion. I mean, and, you know, it's almost impossible to ignore the fact that, you know, this continuing kind of tribalism that we see around so many things, which is interesting to me because, you know, and we talk about left wing and right wing and things like that. Well, once upon a time, not too long ago too, that is that if you voted a certain way, you weren't that. That was just how you were voted. You know, I'm me and I vote Labor. But it's become I'm Labor. You know, it's like you're actually identifying something that technically happens once every 3 to 4 years, you know, as you. So, you know, and to me, you're far more complex than your single political view or any view. And obviously certain views are reprehensible and we have to draw a line under those ones. But for the vast majority of people, your opinion is your opinion. And if you share it with someone and they don't like it, you may have a conversation about it, but again, in the vast majority of cases, surely we can we don't need to change your opinion.
No,
if your opinion is and you can be flipping around or whatever it is, but you know, you can, if someone has an opinion about religion, for instance, you know, their belief is there is God and it's a Christian God. Now, as a person and about how they express that, that's obviously really important. But that in itself, and I'm not now talking about actions, but I'm talking about that someone who holds that opinion, that's their opinion or belief or whatever you want to describe it. And so it's not my role to try and change them. And again, coming back to, the way I approach things, I want to tell you a story, and I'm hoping that there is some learning in for you in that story. But it's not like, you know, the story doesn't start, thou shalt now obey. You know, it's not that. It's about engaging and having people, if they want and they see something for them, in learning from it. And this idea of, you know, competing opinions is great because what else are you going to talk about? You know, talk about the fact that everyone loves vanilla.
That's right.
Everyone loves vanilla ice cream. Well, you know, and politically, you know, there's the left wing and the right wing, but we all know that a bird can't fly with only one wing. You know, and if you've ever been in a boat with one oar on one side, all you do is go around in circles.
Those metaphors again, Mark.
That's it. I can't help it.
They just keep oozing out of you.
That's it. They keep coming. and obviously I'm still the cognitive faculties are still working enough that I'm not mixing them.
What?
That's right. When you start going downhill and you start mixing your metaphors.
Yeah, but that's you do realize that's only because you're so excited that you've got so many. You just can't process it and you don't so have the many. Skill. There's so many metaphors. You just want to mix them all up. That's the ultimate.
I'm just waiting for you to give me the. I'm just waiting for you to give me that chance in the conversation for me to jump in and just start writing the metaphors down.
Well, I'll give you a little chance here. You can always inject one in this quote that I'm going to squeeze out of you. So if you want to, I said before that generally at the end of all these podcasts, I sort of say to people, there's a lot of things we've spoken about, but quite like even that you like, there's like such, I don't know what the attraction is about quotes. Maybe it's part of that whole storytelling thing. It's like a little tiny like tweet from Twitter version of like a story. There's like, you know, quotes, it's sort of this grab. So have you got something that you really like, that you want to share?
I've got millions of them.
Just one.
I'm literally trying to put them in some kind of order. So I'm not going to ask. I'm just going to say it. I'm going to steal a space. So I've got two, and one is that for those people listening, is that and those listening don't realise that you and I can see each other, and but this is an audio only presentation. Is that I quoted a gentleman before by the name of Aldo Leupold. I suggest people, if you can, look him up and look at some of his quotes because they are truly insightful. But there is one particular story piece he wrote called "Think Like a Mountain," and it talks about his learning and realization of the point of the place of all animals within an ecosystem, and specifically, he's talking about predators. It's called "Think Like a Mountain," and the idea is that, you know, we as humans think in very short periods of time. Mountains think differently, and we need to maybe we can learn from that. The second one, I think, is really is a short quote, and it's actually on my computer. So it's probably the one I should share with you. I have it on my computer. So
you'll have to say it out loud because
yeah, I will. But I'm showing it to you so people listening know that I'm actually saying. So this is not made up. I've made like a little, you know, a cardboard triangle like that you might have on a desk to show your name or your title, and it sits on top of my computer. And the inspiration of this great quote is that television series Serenity and the movie Firefly. So yeah, it's real high brow, but I love it. It is, "I am a leaf on the wind. Watch how I soar." Yeah.
Exactly. I like a good cliche. You know why?
That's one of my favorite quotes.
No, but it's true. Like maybe it's an Australian thing too, but there's often a dumbing down of, like, especially really cliches, but they're often just really good and they're really true. And but they're like so true and used so often that people are like, "Oh, I've heard that a lot," but it still remains that is true. So as we're reaching the climax of this podcast, Mark.
Yes. So
as we're reaching the climax, how would you like for people to find out more about all the various things that you get up to from the podcast to the different videos? Give people like just a bit of a overview with your URLs or however you want.
So if you'd like to so I have a couple of URLs one is my own business URL, which is cdiconsulting.com.au. If you're particularly interested in talking to me about executive coaching, you can find my mug and my bio on Executive Central Group, which is executivecentral.com.au, and just look for Mark Vandenbogart in the team. You'll see a photo of me and the other people I work with in the executive coaching space. If you're interested in my outdoor life, probably the best place to start is on The Hunter's Campfire on YouTube, and that's, as it says, The Hunter's Campfire. Just so you know, if you think there might be more than one name, throw up the little emblem is a campfire with the word "The Hunter's Campfire" around it, so it's pretty obviously sent. And you'll also find the Hunter's Campfire podcast on Facebook, and you'll also find the Hunter's Campfire podcast on Instagram, and you'll also find the audio versions, because we have both audio and video versions of the podcast on YouTube, but we'll find the audio only versions of the podcast, that is the Hunter's Campfire podcast, wherever you get your audio podcast. So Spotify, Google, iHeartRadio, Podbean, all those ones. We're out there in the moments. And it's generally 1.5 to 2 hours of people just talking about stuff, like all good podcasts.
Like we're doing.
Like just like this great podcast.
Yeah, that's it. And you can ignore all the other search results for the other Mark Van den Bogart, who's some Dutch soccer player.
Yes, because I get frequent requests to connect on LinkedIn from people in Holland.
I didn't realize there was another Mark Van den Bogart
and Facebook.
I was like searching and he was everywhere. He's like some soccer player.
I get him on Facebook and I'm kind of going, who is this person? Oh, it's in Holland. Ah, that's probably what it is. Yes. That's it.
So thank you once again, a good friend, for hopping on the podcast. Great as always. And any last words?
Other than say thank you for the hour and a half of, or even more, hour and 40 minutes of the opportunity to ramble and to, you know, tell tall tales and speak about stuff that I really enjoy, probably more enjoy. That's part of who I am and what I really like to do. I appreciate your time. And for those who don't know, Saul and I do this on a regular basis, but there's usually beer involved. So this has been a dry event. So
yeah, we usually do.
I'm not sure if that makes it better or worse, but either way, it's certainly been an enjoyable. And again, so I've very much appreciated your attentive nature and asking me questions that make me think.
Yeah, no, always explain, talking about things very eloquently as well. So thanks, Mark. And
not bad from a boy from Petrie Terrace, huh?
Not bad at all. And so with that in mind, that's actually it for today, guys. Thanks so much for listening into our podcast yet again. Before we go, please leave your feedback as well as any suggestions for any topics you would like us to discuss in future episodes. And thanks again for listening to the Grow Your Business podcast, and we'll see you again soon. Bye, guys.
Thanks for tuning in to today's episode of Grow Your Business. Have a great day, and we'll see you next time here at the Grow Your Business podcast.